This bracha is the most edited version of the bracha, of all the brachot in the Amidah, perhaps in the entire Siddur, for reasons that will become obvious. Some of those were external censorship. Some of those were internal censorship. But either way, if you see a version of this bracha that you do not say, there are many, many versions of this bracha. I did not bring all of them, even small, tiny word changes from version to version, even within a traditional, like, if you're an Ashkenaz davener, even within Nusach Ashkenaz, there are multiple versions of this tefillah. So if it's not exactly the words that you're used to, you're in good company. The second box that I brought you here is a version of the Nusach Eretz Yisrael. As you may remember, there are two versions, big picture, two versions of the Siddur, just like there are two versions of the Talmud. There's the Talmud Bavli, which we call the Talmud. And then there's the Talmud Yerushalmi, which is the other Talmud, which we only usually learn in contrast to the Bavli, although it's more in vogue now to look at the Yerushalmi on its own. Same thing with the Siddur. The Siddur that we all daven from, and when I say we, I mean everybody who davens today from any geographic right. So if you're Moroccan, Tunisian, Chinese, Indian, all these people, all of us, are all davening a version of the Babylonian Siddur. But there was another Siddur that existed in Jewish history that was run out of town about 1,000 years ago, which was the version of the Siddur from the Eretz Yisrael community that ended up leaving Eretz Yisrael, as most of the rest of the Jews did. And we know it from the fact that there was an Eretz Yisrael shul in, Baruch Hashem, Old Cairo, where the Geniza also was parked. And so when people were done with their Siddur from their Eretz Yisrael shul, they would throw it into the Geniza, just like all the other Bavel people were doing. And so when the Geniza was uncovered like 120 years ago, they discovered the Eretz Yisrael Siddur, which had not seen the light of day for hundreds and hundreds of years. Salman Schechter actually published the Amidah according to the Eretz Yisrael Siddur in 1896, and the four people who read the article were blown away, okay? That was actually the moment of us coming to a realization that there's not just one Siddur that scatters into different geographic rites in the Middle Ages, but there were older traditions that came from before that. The Eretz Yisrael Siddur is evidence of that, just like the Talmud Yerushalmi. That's the second box. Okay, so the second box on the page is the Eretz Yisrael version. And the reason I want us to look at both of them is because sometimes when you look at a tefillah, but all you know is the words you know, and you don't see what other editorial choices were on the table, then you don't necessarily notice everything that you might notice. So I'm bringing this almost as a way to highlight the version that we have. Let's hear from you just a couple of questions that emerged from the text.
Why are all the fours on the first one? We found an enormous amount of fours on the first one.
Fours?
Number four. Okay. We have four vavs.
Vela malchinim, vechol arisha, vechol ayvecha, vehazedin.
You have four categories.
Good.
You have four verbs for destruction.
Ta'aker, tishaber, timager, tachnia.
And you have four words of the hatima, shover oyvim
u'machnia zedim. Shover oyvim u'machnia zedim. Which is an oddity there. Okay, great.
Four words in the first three lines.
Good. Okay, great. So that's a great noticing, and actually the looking for numbers in the Amidah is a good strategy. The Amidah, when it was 18 blessings, not 19 blessings, was very symmetrically numbers-based, right? You have three in the beginning, three in the end, and then you had 12 in the middle, each which could potentially be divided into six and six, and even those six and six could be potentially divided into three, 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 and three. Also, in the first bracha, you have Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, Vael, Agadol, Agibor, Vanora. There's a variety of threes that you could play around in the Amidah. You're noticing the fours. And just a comment is that when you look at the other texts, like you have from Eretz Yisrael, then you see, the pattern of four doesn't seem to hold in that other text. So either it was intentional, like I had an earlier text, we don't know if Eretz Yisrael was earlier, but if it were, I had an earlier text and I monkeyed with it to get to the fours and really push that out there, or I didn't have that and they were sort of breaking down the fours. We don't really know which historic direction that's going. You're making me think of the four kingdoms, which are the sort of traditional enemies of the Jews. which would be a super subtle way of bringing them into the picture, but something about the four. Okay, good. Other questions? Yeah.
Who's the object of the, whatever you want to call it, curse? So a Malshin could be, let's say, Jews who are slandering to the non-Jewish authorities. But then in the second one, Mishum Adim, I mean, that's clearly Jewish. I shouldn't say clearly, but it seems like it's...
The way we use the word now,
right,
yes.
We use that, but, well, it's, it says, so it could be Jewish heretics. And it says, Yimlo Yashuv LeTorah Techa. I mean, come on. If you then return to your Torah, I mean, who else could it be? I feel like it sort of has to be Jews. Then you have Notzrim, and you have Minim. Now, Notzrim are obvious. Well, I shouldn't say obvious about anything.
Yes, it's true. Reuven Kimmel wrote a whole article about how the Notzrim here are not necessarily Christians. Maybe they were a group of people from Nazareth who had nothing to do with Christianity. Anyways, but yes.
So I'm just saying there's a lack of clarity. The second one to me seems to be more clearly directed, seems to us, I should say, more clearly directed to Jews who've gone off the Derech, whereas the first one, it seems like it could be more open. I don't know.
Good. Okay, just to say, like, a little textual variant that might change or strengthen what you're saying. In the first one, V'ha-Zedim, what's Zedim? The Zedim. I called my grandfather Zadie, so I always felt like this was really weird. But no, that's not what it means. What is it?
The heir on purpose.
Yeah, bimezi, right? You're doing something on purpose as opposed to bishoge, ba'zedim. So in many other versions, including the version of Sadia Gaon, which is one of the earliest Siddurim that we have, it says malchut zadon, the kingdoms of insolence, which seems to be, and also is quoting from Jeremiah, seems to be definitely non-Jews. Meaning, as bad as we think the Malshinim are or the Mishum Adim, if they are indeed Jews, the Malchut Zadon is not—it's not a Jewish entity. So there's something going on here with who's the object. And I'm just going back to your four. Normally, the brachot after I say Baruch Ata Hashem, how many words do I have in the Amidah? Baruch Ata Hashem. Pick any other bracha.
Two,
right? Hayel Hakadosh, Honein Adad, right? Arutzeh B'Tshuvah. Here we have four. Which is not only unusual, maybe it's keeping with the four pattern, but also notice that there's two objects, two verbs, two objects, right? Which is very unusual, especially because we have a rule that the Talmud tells us called Ein Chodmin Bishtayim. You cannot have a chatima, an ending of a bracha, with two things. Okay? Here it is, two things. So what's going on there? Right, that's true. That's true. Although in Eretz Yisrael, it's shorter. Hatov lecha lodot or hatov lodot. But anyways, yes. It's not everyone is two, but there's usually one verb and one object. Here you have two verbs and two objects. I'm just getting to here. Maybe there's two schemas that we have to cover here. One is external, one is internal. Perhaps. Okay, but just there's something weird going on there at the end.
Why is there so much emphasis on speed? Especially when this is manifestly something that didn't happen yesterday and we keep praying for it every, like, it's more
yeah, v'chol aibecha mehera yikareitu, v'azidei mehera tishaber, bimhera v'yameinu. You get three bimheras.
And also karegas, right? Like, everything is
Karega. Right now.
And we know that it didn't happen when we said it last time, so, like, what are we doing?
Better luck
exactly?
next time, yes.
I guess, but, yes. Like, it's a little more like, oh, reestablish your courts, right? Well, that could happen eventually, right? But this is, like, in a second, I want this all done.
Yeah, there's some urgency to it, even though, obviously, running most prayers through the supercomputer of, if I pray for it, does it happen automatically, and you get
course.
The answer no.
That would go badly.
So, yeah, exactly, that would go badly. Even they knew that, too. Okay, but there's a sense of urgency here, and there you have the three, not four, but nice if there was a fourth one. Okay, yeah.
With respect to all of the verbs that are used in these prayers, are they merely there for poetic amplification, or did the authors intend for the verbs to mean something different?
Good.
In terms of what kind of action was to be taken against the sinners?
Excellent. So is shover different from machnia in the end, or te'aker, tishaver, timager? Is that just like yikadal, yikadash? Yiparach, Yishabach, Yipar, Yitrabach. Now, each of those might be indicating something separate also. But you could ask that for all the brachas of the Amidah. Slach lanu avin kichatanu, mechal lanu malkein kifashanu. What's the difference between slicha and mechila? Is there a difference? Is it a synonym? Right? And you're playing this out over and over again, and that where you would also ask that question here. Are they significant, or are they just meant to maybe create a sense of urgency or something else going on there?
Why do we need malshinim if we've got kol harashah? In other words, aren't Malshinim sinners?
Root is Lashon. So they're slandering you, but probably as Adam was saying, slandering you meaning not like I called you a name, but more like I turned you into the Roman government.
I understand, but why? But aren't they should they be
covered?
Are covered by
good.
The Rishon.
Excellent. I love it. Yes. There are so many people here. Why can't we just have one term that covers them? By the way, we have V'chol HaRish'ah, all evil,
right.
But in other versions in Nusach Ashkenaz, it's V'chol Ha, as you said, Rishaim, right? Maybe it's not all evil, like capital E, which might work well. Actually, just take a look. Does anyone ever daven the weekday Amida in the Reform Sidur? A very small number of people are using that section of the Sidur. But there it is. Take a look on page 3 for a second. Look at the Mishkan Tefillah. This is an amazing innovation for those of you who are following the history of Reform liturgy. For like 110 years, there was no bracha against the heretics in the Reform liturgy. Gone, struck. It was like if you had a vote of what you were going to strike in 19th century Germany, this was top 2, okay? It was out. But they brought it back in the Mishkan Tefillah, and then just take a look at it. V'larish'ah alti tikva. Okay, rish'ah, capital E, evil. Not evildoers, but evil. I want no hope for evil. V'hato'im elecha yashuvu. That's actually drawing on the Eretz Yisrael idea of im lo yashuvu l'torah techa. They don't return to your Torah. Here they're just sort of baking that in here. The wandering ones or the misguided ones should return to you. And then Malchut Zadon, but they're willing to go for people when it comes to the non-Jewish threat. By the way, when I'm not being political, I'm just noting here sociologically, when Trump was elected, this bracha got very popular in certain circles.
Yes.
And the Malchut Zadon was like leading the way, okay? So Malchut Zadon stays in Meherat Tishaber, and then Baruch Atah Hashem Shover Resha Mina Aretz, okay? It's all theoretical except for the Malchut Zadon who are people. Right, and so they're narrowing down the options here in terms of the who's at stake, and we're keeping the non-Jewish threat as people as opposed to evil capital E. There are no Jewish threats here. Okay, few other noticings. Yeah, please.
Hope for what?
What hope do we want them not to have?
Yes.
Good. Okay. Yeah. Excellent. Good. Yep.
This is a subcategory of who's the object of this prayer, and that is the suffix in line 3, your enemies, God's enemies.
Good.
It doesn't say in the previous lines, those who slander you, those who commit wickedness against you.
Good.
So is it all the same? Is it God's enemies versus, is it all about God's
enemies? Yeah, and another version of this is not oivecha, but rather oive amcha, the enemies of your people. Which is big, that's a big difference than oivecha. Oivecha could be people who are not threatening the Jewish people at all. But oivei amcha is sort of brings that more narrowly. Just on the tikva, just take a look for a second. We're not spending a lot of time on the sources of these words. It's the flip of Yirmiyahu's comforting prophecy. Komar Hashem, mini kolech mi bechi, veinaich mi dima, ki yesh schar l'f'ulatech, num Hashem, v'shavu meretz oyev, v'yesh tikva, the yesh tikva is who has a hope for the end. The end is actually going to work out well for some people, for the people who remain in Jeremiah's prophecy. Even though I'm living in the age of destruction, that's not the forever state of the world. Yesh tikva, there is hope going down the line. But for these people, may there not be hope. Meaning, not just like they'll be depressed. It's like they're not going to show up. When we all shavu banim ligvulam, they're not coming, right? They're out of that whole thing. They've checked out of that sort of long game of the Jewish people here. All right, we'll take one or two more. Yeah.
So in the Ashkenazi version, it's against both external and internal evil people. And the Eretz Yisrael version is just internal. And so maybe so I was wondering whether that might have been, this was written in times of being under Roman domination. They were being very careful as a political statement not to say anything that might be viewed as encouraging, the destruction of the masters.
Okay, great. So is there a political, I'm turning your statement into a question.
Is there a political
possibility for the choice of the words here such that in Eretz Yisrael, where, by the way, Christianity obviously stronger in the Eretz Yisrael milieu, you know, than oh, in Bavo, right? In other words, Notzri means something to these people, assuming it means Christian. Also, does Notzri mean a Jew who turned into a Christian, which is the meaning of the word mean? It turns into a Jew who becomes a Christian, although it's a word that's older than Christianity. So it can't always have meant that. Right? I mean, it's a heretic in the lowercase h, right? Just somebody who follows another pathway. But eventually turns into a Jew who turns into a Christian. So if, when is this written, and does the word mean, this word, indicate somebody who is a Jew who turned into a Christian?
Or just any
Jew who has some heterodox view that's not accepted anymore? Or is it somebody on the outside, like Notzrim today? When we say Notzrim, we don't mean a Jew who became a Christian. We just mean somebody who's a Christian. Plenty of pagans became Christian. So that just wonder, we don't know exactly what they meant by these words, but if they did mean what you're saying, then you might back it into political motivations. So I just want to say, Ruth Langer, who teaches at Boston College, wrote an entire book on this bracha called Cursing the Christians? One of the only books I think that I have to turn around on my bookshelf. So the spine isn't facing outwards. But yes, it's like there are certain interpretations of this through the ages that gain certain meaning, even if we don't know the original moment of interpretation of what they were intending. Okay.
If all evil instantly perished, what would that look like?
Oh.
Yeah.
Like, boom, it's over.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. What would it look like if this actually happened speedily, karega, in a moment? Has that ever happened? Could it happen again? There's a lot more of questions. By the way, just this exercise, taking a bracha, that you might say a lot, asking questions about it, opens up the bracha in new ways. We don't have to have answers for all the questions, but just as like an opportunity to sit with something that we say a lot or might say a lot, I want to give that to you as something we can do. We're going to spend a good amount of time on the where does this show up in the history of the Amidah, the case that the Bavli gives us about this, but the Yerushalmi has a different understanding of it, and all this is going to help us understand who might have written this kind of bracha, right? Who is the person who's motivated to say these words? What's going on for them? Yeah,
Shmuel
HaKatan. Okay, so that's the Bavli's position. Is Shmuel HaKatan is the guy who wants to say this. The standard line, which we're going to look at in a minute, but the standard line of the Bavli is, there was a beautiful bracha, a series of brachot, called the Shmona Asrei, and that lasted for a while. And then something happened, and we had to add a 19th bracha, and this is it. Okay, that's if you're going to summarize the history of this, according to the Bavli. But that means, up until that point, there was like a fantastically non-cursing Amidah that was out there, and everybody was happy and, you know, just asking for things, but not really about other people or cursing them. And then this thing sort of came and, you know, gummed up the works in that way. But let's take a look at, it's not always, that's not the only understanding of the Amidah. Why do we have 18 brachot in the Amidah in the first place? Why is 18 so significant? Actually, a number of midrashim that play on this question. Why 18? Imagine if it was 7, which we have on Shabbat, or 9, which we have on Rosh Hashanah Musaf. It doesn't have to be 18, but they go with 18, and there are a number of reasons. Here's one. Shmona Asrei Brachot Shamru Chachamim Keneged, what are they corresponding to? Shmona Asrei Azkarot Shebehavu L'Adonai B'nei Elim. Right? Havu L'Adonai B'nei Elim in Psalm 29. We know it from Kabbalah Shabbat liturgy. How many times do you say God's name, Yud Heh Vav Heh, in that psalm? Count it up next time. It's 18. So 18 brachot is corresponding to the 18 mentions of God's name, Yud Heh Vav Heh, in Psalm 29, which it's not a super long psalm. That's a lot of mentions of God's name, like in a psalm. So it might be significant, although it's not exactly clear why you would then base our entire, like everything that we ever say in any Jewish prayer service based on that. But now, this is what I want to pay attention to, we get a sub-clause to this. Oh, you have to have 18 brachot, because there's 18 mentions of God's name in this psalm. What about the following? Kolel shel minim b'shel prushim, b'shel gerim b'shel zekenim, b'shel David b'bonei Yerushalayim. Im amar elu latzman ve'elu latzman yatsa. Now we get an instruction. First is an explanation. We get 18 brachot, corresponding to the 18 mentions of God's name. But an instruction. What if you don't have 18 brachot? How am I supposed to deal with it? Now, it seems like from this situation, there were more than 18 brachot. Imagine like an editing table. I got a lot of brachot, and I want to get it down to 18. How can I do this? Well, maybe what I'm going to do is kolel, let's take the easier one, kolel shel gerim b'shel zikenim. Put the gerim bracha with the zikenim bracha, okay? Which is what we do. Al tzadikim ve'al chasidim ve'al ziknei amcha beit Yisrael v'zikenim, right? Ve'al pleitzat soferim ve'al gerim atzedek. Okay, so the zikenim and the gerim end up showing up in the same bracha. By the way, not totally obvious. You could add a whole bracha just for gerim, which in fact is how it is in Eretz Yisrael. They just have the gerim bracha. And you could have had a whole bracha just for tzadikim or chasidim or zikenim. Okay, you could see that bracha as like an amalgam. And what's the end of that bracha? Mish'an u'mivtach latzadikim. You can see mish'an, the mish'an like a staff, you lean on it. Something you can lean on, u'mivtach, and a security, latzadikim, for the righteous. But you have two, whatever, adjectives or nouns that are describing the way they're being relying on. And you could have just had one. Could have just been mivtach latzadikim. So you could see maybe there's an echo of like, Mish'an lagerim u'mivtach latzadikim. Okay, but you can see in this Tosefta, the oldest layer of our texts, rabbinic texts, they're already saying you combine it. How about Shel David bebone Yerushalayim? What are we talking about there? What's our David bracha? Et Tzemach David, which ends? It starts at Tzemach David, Tzemach David, Matzmiach, Keren Yeshua. Or it could have been Baruch Atah Hashem, Magen David. Where do you know that from? Yeah. Totally reasonable. If you have a David bracha, why don't you just end with David? Okay? David, et sema shel David, be bonei Yerushalayim. What's the bonei Yerushalayim bracha? How does that end?
Bonei Yerushalayim.
Okay? Now, in Bavel, those are two different brachot, right? Bonei Yerushalayim then leads to et sema David. But in Eretz Yisrael, when Schechter published it in 1896, and those four people saw it, what they noticed was, it wasn't 19 brachot, it was 18 brachot. And guess what? Our bracha against the meaning was in the 18. You know what got combined? Et Tzemach David and Bonei Yerushalayim, one bracha, Elohei David, Bonei Yerushalayim. Huh. Elohei David, God of David, Bonei Yerushalayim, who rebuilds Jerusalem. And turns out, that's also in the Yerushalmi. I mean, Yerushalmi is aware that that's the combined version of the bracha. Which now makes me scratch my head and say, maybe the extra bracha wasn't the Birkat HaMinim. Maybe Birkat HaMinim was always there. And we have another bracha that was sort of split out from Bonei Yerushalayim into its own Et Tzemach David. Why? Different shiur. Okay, what about ours? Kolel shel minim b'shel prushim. Minim, that's ours, Birkat HaMinim. Even though in the Ashkenaz version doesn't actually say the word minim, kind of weird. Leave it aside. That's the censors. Kolal shel minim, that's our bracha. B'shel prushim, what are the prushim?
Separators.
Yeah, the separators. Not the good guy prushim, also known as the Pharisees. No, it can't be them. It's got to be the bad guy prushim, like Poresh Minat Sibor, right? Who separate themselves from the community. Let's put them all in one list. And now we've got a history for multiple objects of the curse, right? Minim and Prushim in one bracha. We got that. That's our bracha. And we threw in a few others just for good measure. Okay, so this is the oldest history of this bracha from the Tosefta. It exists old. Now, we've already wondered and complicated the issue with how the Bavli is going to present to us this bracha. So now we have to read the Bavli, see what's going on, check out Shmuel HaKatan, get a whole new view of what this bracha is about. Who's going to read for me? Rabban Gamliel Omer, the Mishnah.
Rabban Gamliel Omer, b'chol yom v'yom mitpalel adam shmona esrei.
Great. Rabban Gamliel says, this is in the Mishnah, in Brachot. Rabban Gamliel says, each and every day, mitpalel adam, what's that? What's an adam? A person. Everybody. Everybody. Not just the men. Not just the Kohanim. Not just the people who know the Sidur. Everybody has to daven. Lipalel in rabbinic literature almost always means tefillah, means the Amida. Lipalel b'chol yom v'yom mitpalel adam shmona esrei, 18. Okay? The full Monty brachot. 18 brachot. Okay? You're going to say them all, says Rabban Gamliel. But we have a machloket. So let's get the machloket.
Rabbi Yeshua Omer.
Me'ein Shmona Esrei. No, actually, you don't have to say 18. You can say Me'ein, essence of 18, like Me'ein Olam Haba. It's the taste of the 18. It's not the real 18. Okay, that's Rabbi Yeshua. So on one end we got Rabbi Gamliel. Everybody says every word. Rabbi Yeshua says, nah, everybody can say essence of 18. All right, that's the machloket. Now, that's the end of the Mishnah, or the quote from the Mishnah we're looking at here. Now we're going to bring in the Bavli. Hani Tam Nisrei, Chasrei Havyan. Wait a minute. These Tam Nisrei, Taf and Shin switch, right? These Shmona Esrei, Chasrei, there are actually 19. This is a great noticing by the Gemara. You said 18, Rabban Gamliel, but I looked at my Sidur. I counted 19. What's going on? Okay, notice. It's a question by the Gemara. I mean, the latest layer of the Gemara asks this question. Okay, so it's not live in the Beit Midrash of Rabban Gamliel. Somebody said, wait a minute, I'm looking at the Sidur, and it goes to page 177, so how could it be you're saying 18, there's 19? No, later, like hundreds of years later, the editor of the Gemara throws that in there, but they're stitching together two texts. So let's take a look at the, now we're safely back to Hebrew. Tana Rabbanan is introducing what again? Braita, which is as old as the Mishnah, fair game, okay?
Shimon, is it Hapakuli?
Yep. Shimon. It's a good question because this is literally the only time he ever appears in all of rabbinic literature.
How interesting.
So we do not know what it means or how to say it exactly. Some people translate it as flax worker. I don't know.
Okay.
Shimon. Maybe he's from a place called Pakul. Maybe it's something else. We don't know.
Shmona Pakuli, Zdir Shmona Asre Brachot, Lifne Rabban Gamliel, Al Haseder Beyavna.
Okay. Shmona Pakuli, this guy who we've never heard of, who's not a rabbi, right, orders the 18 Brachot before Rabban Gamliel in order at Yavne. When you read in the little notes in the Sidur and it says the Amida was written in the court of Rabban Gamliel, they're talking about this sentence. Shimon HaPakuli, a guy we've never heard of and we'll never hear from again, has an amazing, no small part, only small actors, amazing walk-on role for Jewish history. I will walk on to the stage. I will order the entire Shmona Esrei and I will disappear. And I will leave it for all of us to grapple with forever. Okay, you can thank Shimon HaPakuli, or maybe not. What does he do? What is his action here?
He steered.
He steered. Yeah, he ordered it. He didn't write it. Okay? He ordered it. He put it in order. And maybe it's like you got it on the editing table and you got to call all this and that, and maybe he's doing that. Or maybe he's just a guy who's plucked off the street. Hey, you! Come on over here. Recite the Amida. I bet you can do it. Take that, Rabbi Yeshua. This guy can do it. All right? Watch him. Shimon HaPakuli does it. All right. Now, what happens? Rabbi Gamliel says, Amar Lahem. Keep going at him.
Amar Lahem Rabban Gamliel Chachamim. All
right, so we get this question from Rabban Gamliel. Is there anybody here who knows how to litaken? How would you translate that? What?
Fix
or affix. That's a big difference. Are you repairing it like tikkun olam? Or are you litaken like a takana? Are you, you know, making it a thing? Okay, establishing it. Okay, so not totally clear, but we want some. Does anybody know how to litakein the birkat aminim? And now we get your buddy. Go ahead, Adam.
Yeah, Mashmuel Hakatan v'tikna.
Yes, right. Utikana, utikenota. A Mashmuel Hakatan, and he did it. Whatever litakein means, Shmuel Hakatan does it. Great story. Hey, there are 18 brachot, says Rabban Gamliel. The Gemara says, wait a minute, I know there are 19 brachot. Oh yeah, funny story. One time, this guy, Shimon HaPakuli, walked in the Beit Midrash, did it, and then Rabban Gamliel says, can anybody fix or affix the Birkat Aminim? Shmuel Katan stood up, did it. Answer to the question is, Shmuel Katan wrote the 19th bracha. End of story, right? Sounds good. I got it. That's my history of the Amida, according to the Bavli. Now, the Braita doesn't end and gives us a little odd coda. Let's read it. Go ahead. Okay. Another one, some later year, he forgot it. That would be the simplest way to translate Lishkoach. He forgot it. Okay. Vihishkif, go ahead. And he looked at it 2 or 3 hours or moments. Velohelu. And they didn't remove him, lift him up. lift him up because the leader of the davening was davening from a pit because I call to you from the pit. So the guy who's leading the Amida is in the pit, and if you do something wrong, if you make a mistake, I remember the gong show? I yank you out by pulling you up, okay? I hoist you out of the davening pit, toss you aside, and get in someone who can do it right, okay? Lo he'eluhu. They did not do that for Shmuel HaKatan. End of story. All right, well, this is a strange end to the story because what do we know about Shmuel HaKatan and Birkat Hamini? We don't know that much about it except for the fact that he's the guy who wrote it, okay? So why, how did he forget it another year? Like, a year passes, and like, what was that thing I did?
No, but he's also not a rabbi.
Okay, he's not a rabbi, although he's a Tana. He doesn't have the appellation. But unlike Shimon HaPakuli, he is quoted elsewhere, and halachot come in his name. So you're right. It is interesting that he doesn't have the Yerushalmi. I don't think we're going to see it, but the Yerushalmi says, why was he Shmuel HaKatan? Why was he little Shmuel? So one possibility is he was a short guy. Another possibility, says Yerushalmi, is
Shmuel.
That's right.
Well, Rob's buddy.
Rob, you know. Right. No. Okay, he precedes Shmuel,
yeah.
Another authority without a title.
Right.
But the Yerushalmi says he's only a little bit less than Shmuel HaRamati. Who's Shmuel HaRamati?
Oh, wow.
The original Shmuel, okay? The guy from Ramah, that is to say the prophet, okay? In other words, Shmuel HaKatan has some prophetic abilities. He doesn't need the title rabbi. He's like embodying the his namesake, Shmuel HaNavi, Shmuel
HaRamati. But your question feels like a trick question. If you're supposed to say the prayers every day,
yeah.
How can you forget?
Yeah, exactly. This doesn't make any sense at all. How could he forget the bracha, especially if he's saying it every day?
Well, maybe.
Did he not go to shul? Was he one of those rabbis who likes to learn but not daven? I'm just saying, whatever, I haven't met any.
That's my favorite.
Okay, yeah, he forgot it. What does it mean he forgot it? Was it like, oh man, I remembered everything else, but I just forgot? Or was it like, I remembered it yesterday I remembered it, and tomorrow I remembered it, just today I had a bad day, and Baruch Hashem, they didn't take me out from leading. What happened? What happened to the rest of the Amida there? Like, we don't have any information. This is the end of the story, yeah.
I mean, I wonder with verbs like Sider and BK.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's pretty accepted that this was oral and mutable to a certain extent.
And that, oral, definitely.
And that,
there's
and
a fight about the mutability of it, just in scholarship.
Here it seems remarkably mutable, right? And that, to me, this passage, it suggests to me that this is a very tricky blessing. Gamaliel called out publicly, can anyone get this right?
Yes.
And the only guy who could get it right,
yes,
couldn't get it right every time.
Exactly.
And that didn't hold him back. That almost argues why we have so many versions of the
bracha. Oh, I love it. I love it. Something's going on here beyond, hey, I need a bracha for this. Could you write it? I'll write it. Now we all say it. It's something else is going on here. Yeah.
Say it. Is that the implication of lo ha'aluhu? That like he forgot it and everybody else said, yeah, it's not that important or it's not essential?
Okay, good. What? Sometimes you forget something and it's like, okay, I had a bad day. But sometimes you forget something and there's a consequence and you just by the skin of your teeth didn't get the consequence, which is hello, and that's what we see here. This doesn't really make any sense unless you imagine that he's leading the Amida. He's not just like over here. It's like, oh, I forgot that over here. No. He's in the pit. He's leading everybody. Can you imagine the awkwardness of it? He stops davening because he doesn't say the words anymore. And then they're like looking around. What should we do? We're going to let you continue. Lo he'elu. Now, it makes more sense when we look at the parallel in the Yerushalmi, which we're going to do right now. Because thank God, the Yerushalmi has another version of this story, which has to make a little bit more sense. But just before we get there, one thing that we know about Shmuel HaKatan is quoted in Pirkei Avot. Right? You're learning Pirkei Avot, right? This is like probably 4 years ago for you. Okay, in chapter 4. Binfol oyivcha al tismach, right? Vikoshlo al yageh libecha. Don't rejoice in the downfall of your enemies, says the book of Proverbs. Now, notice how Shmuel HaKatan got into Pirkei Avot. Most people get into Pirkei Avot by saying something that they innovated. Shmuel Katan got into Pirkei Avot. This is the only time he appears in Pirkei Avot. He got into Pirkei Avot simply by quoting a line from Proverbs. You know who else could have gotten into Pirkei Avot that way? Everybody, right? So what is it about Shmuel HaKatan and this line that is so essential that he ends up being in Pirkei Avot as a result of this line? There's something about it that is, he is thinking about Oivim, okay? He has a connection, he's preoccupied with the Oivim, with the enemies. And here he's saying, don't rejoice in the downfall of your enemy. Okay, so this leads to some nice drashot. In the Koran Sacks, the Sidur that we daven out of here, is a little nice thing, sort of along your lines, which Rabbi Sacks said, which is only somebody who has the spiritual orientation to enemies of you cannot rejoice in their downfall could write this bracha. And it wasn't vengeful. It wasn't like, let's go take them down. It's, I'm not going to be sad, but you know what, there are threats, and so we have to say something, but I'm not going to rejoice in it. Let's get the Yerushalmi. Now, as you know, the Bavli story, sometimes they exist on their own, sometimes they exist in relationship to the Yerushalmi, and the Yerushalmi is, in some ways, the kernel of the story that develops into the Bavli version of the story, even though the Bavli was a Braita, but leave that for the Talmud scholars. Okay, this is the Yerushalmi version of Shmuel HaKatan. It is not set up like the Bavli does to say what's the 19th bracha. We're just going to get a story about Shmuel HaKatan and this bracha, separate from the number of brachot in the Amidah. Okay? Ashkach Tanai Upalig. We find a Tanaitic debate. Palig, like plige, machloket. Let's hear it.
Lakol, ein machsirin oto chutz mi me shelo.
Yeah, Mimi Shalo Amar.
Mechaye Hametim, Umachni Azedim, U Vone Yerushalayim, Ani Omer, Mihu.
Excellent. Okay. You do not make anybody go back to say the Amidah from the beginning. If you make a mistake in the Amidah, you can keep on going, except in the following three cases. If you don't say Mechaye Hametim, God who resurrects the dead, which we know is a controversial idea. Already going back to Josephus points this out, and remains until today. If you don't say that, if you don't say Machni Azedim, that's our bracha. Notice it only has one verb, one object, not two verbs, two objects. That was the ending in Eretz Yisrael, which is parallel to the Yerushalmi's tradition. If you don't say this bracha, Machni Azedim, and if you don't say Bonei Yerushalayim, who rebuilds Jerusalem, why you wouldn't say that, I don't know, but there was some category of people who apparently weren't interested in Jerusalem being rebuilt. Leave that for another commentary. Ani Omer, I say, mean who? Ah, you are a mean. You know the best way I can find my greatest mean test? Not means test. My greatest mean test? Hey, why don't you lead the Amidah today? Let me hear you. I want to hear you. Each bracha. Okay, if you're not saying Machni Azedim Velaminim Alti Tikva, then maybe you're a mean. I say you're a mean. So everybody else has got to go back and those people, you got to make them say it again. Yeah.
But reviving the dead is different.
Yeah.
Right? Reviving the dead, he might be a Sadducee, but yeah. It's not necessarily that he's a Christian.
That's true. Christian. It's a way of, in this tiny little Braita, it's a way of separating out.
But
which community
but
you're a part of.
Kind
of. So maybe you don't like reviving the dead because you're at Tzeduki, and you don't like Machni Azedim because you're a Zaid.
But mean is, I think, not Christian. It's just a cult follower.
Good, yeah.
Right? So
you're following another way.
So.
Yeah, good. You're a heretic, lowercase h.
Right.
Okay, that's the rule. Now we get our guy, Shmuel HaKatan. Here he shows up. Shmuel HaKatan, Avar Koma Tevuta, Over lifnei ateva. What's over lifnei ateva?
Led the prayer.
Yeah, led the Amidah specifically. Passes before the art. So let's say in Eretz Israel language. The Ashkar Machni Azedim Bisofa. Or maybe Bisofa is the beginning of the next sentence. He erases Machni Azedim. Sound familiar? This is the second half of our Bavli story. Right? Shmuel HaKatan, a guy I haven't heard of yet, in this story, in this context, shows up. And he, one day, didn't say Machni Azedim. And what's supposed to happen to him, as the Braita just told us? Machzi Rino Tom, make him say it again, or else take him out. Shari Mashko Valeon. He starts looking around at them. Amrin Le, they say to him, Lo Shiaru Chachamim Kach, or maybe Bach in other manuscripts. The Chachamim didn't take you into account when they made this rule. You're good. Shmuel HaKatan, you're okay. Anyone else who doesn't say Machne HaZidim, Ani Omer Minhu, but you're good. Okay? So now we have a story, right, where Shmuel HaKatan, this is not the Bavli version of the story. This is the story in which Shmuel HaKatan, what do we know about Shmuel HaKatan and his relationship to this prayer? We only know one thing. He never said it. He's not going to say that prayer, right? I don't say Machne HaZidim.
But maybe that's because he was always saying the other proverb.
Maybe he doesn't like the bracha,
even though,
right?
Even though he wrote it.
But he didn't write it here. You get it? In other words, this is where you have to just separate out the two stories. In the Rishalmi, he has nothing to do with the writing. Forgetting it, he couldn't have forgotten it. He never knew it. He never said it. He doesn't say it. The only thing about Shmuel HaKatan we know is that's the guy who doesn't say this bracha. Oh, it's okay. They weren't thinking about you when they made this rule. You got other milas. But did he write the bracha? Absolutely not. That only shows up in the Bavli when the Bavli's scratching their head and saying, wait a minute, there's 18 brachot, I'm counting 19 brachot. We need somebody who's writing a bracha here. Yeah.
So is that the Bavli's way of redeeming him?
So what's the Bavli doing to Shmuel HaKatan? Good. What's the thing about Shmuel HaKatan? Okay, if you only have the Yerushalmi, all you have is a guy who doesn't say this prayer. You don't like the prayer? Neither did he. That's the way it is in the Yerushalmi. Okay? In the Bavli, they can't let go of that scene in which he doesn't say it, but they pack in the first part, right? L'taken, he's the one who establishes it. What could possibly be going on there? I have a thought, but I think it's the right question. We have to try to engage in that question. It can't just be about, well, come on, how many brachot are there? Are there 18? Are there 19? Something else is going. Some other point is being made here. Yeah, please.
It seems they could be splitting the hair.
Yeah.
They didn't say Machni Azedim.
Yeah.
He had a different blessing called Birkat Amenim. Right? Because he was being, he keened, for lack of a better term, Birkat Amenim.
Right.
And then he didn't say
Machni Azedim.
Machni Azedim.
Uh-huh. Right. If you want to read the two stories together, maybe, although how did he end his Birkat Amenim? I mean, even our Birkat Amenim ends Shover Oivim Machni Azedim.
You want to be really crazy, you could say, you know, Ohev Aminim. Right, because he wouldn't want to see their downfall because of what he taught in Pirkei Avot.
Right. Now, Rabban Gamliel would have to be on board with that. Yes, we don't know the words of what he said. You could be really crazy and say that. Yes.
I don't know exactly what a heretic is. But maybe one possibility is that a heretic is a person who refuses to say a statutory prayer. But the principle is I don't like it.
But why don't I like it?
It offends my sensibilities. What I'm getting at is that if the Yerushalmi comes first, the Bavli could be expressing its own discomfort with giving Shmuel HaKatan a pass in the Yerushalmi, and therefore makes it so that it was not actually a deliberate spurning of the prayer, but he merely forgot it.
He just forgot it. That's what was going on.
He wasn't himself a heretic who refused to say a prayer that he found offensive.
Right.
It was rather that he actually is the guy who established the prayer and then he forgot it.
Okay.
And that's why he didn't say it.
Good. I like it. In other words, they have to deal with the fact that he doesn't say it. They can't let that go. That's his defining characteristic.
Right. You can't change the recorded memory that he's the guy who doesn't say.
But we're going to set him up as the guy who's litakaning it first. All right. Now, which you're sort of getting at the same thing. Wait, can I float an idea? And then you'll tell me what you're thinking of. All right. Here's my theory. Are you ready? I think it might have to do with the relationship between Shmuel HaKatan and the main character in this story as well, Rabban Gamliel. Let's take a look at Rabban Gamliel for a second here. You know Rabban Gamliel. Remember him? What's his main problem? If he had a problem at all.
Arrogance.
Yeah, arrogance related to?
Strict constructions.
And who's his main, who's the guy who ends up taking him down? Rabbi Yoshua. Oh, you know, remember when that happens? Right? Rabbi Yoshua. Remember what they're fighting about? Rabban Gamliel versus Rabbi Yoshua.
Yeah.
There is an example on when Yom Kippur is. right? In Masechet Rosh Hashanah, you think it's on this day, and I think it's on that day. You, Rabbi Yeshua, show up on my on the day that you think it's Yom Kippur. You're going to show up with your wallet in my office to prove that you're going to follow my calendar. That is one. There's another one in Bechorot. The one that leads to his actual deposition, meaning being deposed, right, from the leader of the Beit Midrash, is in Brachot. Happens to be one page earlier than where we are right now. And you remember what they're fighting about? Tanu Rabbanan, Abraita. Maaseh b'talmid echad sheba lifnei Rabbi Yoshua. A student comes before Rabbi Yoshua and he says, Tfilat arvi, reshuto chova. Hey, is Mariv allowed or required? Is it reshuto chova? And he says, Rabbi Yeshua says, reshut. You want to do it? Great. You don't want to do it? Fine. That's Rabbi Yeshua's answer. Now, have you ever met a guy like this? Goes to another rabbi and asks the same question. Maybe doesn't like the answer. Ba lifnei Rabban Gamliel, same guy comes before Rabban Gamliel, Amarlo, Tfilat Arvi Rishudo Chova, same question. Hey, is Arvi Rishudo Chova? Amarlo, Chova, Rabban Gamliel, Bechol Yom Vayom Mipalel Adam Shmoneh Asrei Brachot, I'm the guy who says we can all do the Amida, and I'm going to tell you that Arvi is Chova. Okay, Amarlo, the student says, wait a minute, Valo Rabbi Yoshua, Amarli Rishud, wait, Rabbi Yoshua told me that it was just permitted, not required. How does he react? He says, oh, yeah, you see, we're rabbis in the Mishnah, and we believe in machloket. So even though I believe one thing, my colleague can believe something else, and it's totally fine. In fact, it's the beauty of rabbinic literature. That's what he says. Oh, no, actually he says, Hamtain, wait here. Wait till everybody with their shields comes into the Beit HaMidrash. Rashi says that's the students, because they're minatzchim ze'atzeh b'alacha. They're fighting each other in halacha. They're sparring with each other. Wait till everybody comes together. This is going to be a plenary. Everybody in the room. And now I want you to ask your question. So he stands up and he says, he asks his question. Tfilat arvi, reshuto chava. I'm asking, is Tfilat Arvi permitted or required? Amar lo Rabban Gamliel chova. He says, I'll take the first shot at that. It's required. And then he says, Amar lahem Rabban Gamliel lechachamim. Klum yesh adam shecholek badavar zeh? Is there anybody here who disagrees on this matter? What kind of question is that? Yes, we might call it a, what's the correct answer? No, that's right. And that's called a rhetorical question. And Rabbi Yoshua knows the correct answer. And in fact, he gets up and says, Amar le Rabbi Yoshua, love, no, nobody disagrees. I'm good. Whatever you want, whatever you say. Amar lo, and Rabbi Gamliel says, oh, great, good. I was just checking. No, he says, Valo mishimcha merli reshut. No, they told me you said it was reshut. What are you talking about? Amar le Yoshua amora raglecha v'yairu b'cha. Yoshua, stand up and we're going to testify against you. And then the whole thing starts, right? And then they yank out Rabban Gamliel because he's too aggressive against Rabbi Yeshua, blah, 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 Elazar ben Azariah, like 70, the Seder, if you read the rest of it, okay? But just notice the language here for a second. When Rabban Gamliel says to the Chachamim, hey, does anybody disagree with what I'm saying? What are the words he says? Amar lahem Rabban Gamliel lechachamim. Klum yesh adam, which is exactly 100% the same words that Rabbi Gamliel says on the next page of the Gemara in our Braita. Amar lahen Rabbi Gamliel lachachamim, klum yesh adam she yodea letakein birkat amin. It's very rare that you have that number of words that are 100% the same link between the two stories, and it's one page before it in the Gemara. Now, when Rabbi Gamliel says, "Klum yesh adam shecholek b'davar zeh," is there anybody who disagrees with me on this matter? Right? We know the answer is no. It's a rhetorical question where he's looking for the answer to be no. He knows the answer. So maybe there's something going on with Rabbi Gamliel where he's asking something, and the answer is there anybody here who litakein birkat aminim? Anybody here who can litakein birkat aminim? Expecting the answer to be no. And then, out of left field, Shmuel HaKatan stands up and does it. Oh my God, nobody expected that. Not even Shmuel HaKatan, because he's the guy who doesn't like this bracha. He's the only thing we know about him, he doesn't like the bracha. Next year he's going to forget the bracha. And he's nevertheless doing it in that moment. Why? How? Why?
Well, could it be that there was a backstory?
Oh, the backstory. Yeah. Yes.
And that it was just like he forced Rabbi Yeshua to do it here, he's forcing Shmuel HaKatan.
Okay, good. We have to investigate what is the relationship between Shmuel HaKatan and Rabban Gamliel. And it turns out there is a backstory relationship, but it's not one of intimidation like Rabbi Yeshua, but rather mollification. This is the one guy who seems to be able to mollify Rabban Gamliel in his anger. All right? How do we know? We have a couple sources on it. Take a look on the bottom of page 6. I love these stories. All right. You know what Yibor HaShanah is? Remember? We're in it right now. Intercalating the year. Intercalate means you add another month to the year. Okay? Me'abrin, la'aber HaShanah, Yibor. It's a pregnant year. Ein me'abrin HaShanah, ela mezumanin la. We do not intercalate the year except for those who are invited to do so. How would they intercalate the year? The court had to declare that the moon was of a certain blah, blah, blah. And so if we don't have the right people to do that in court, in other words, it's not a calendar that's preset, you have to declare it in the court. Only the people who are invited to participate in this can do it. Now we get a story with Rabban Gamliel. Maaseh, a story, but Rabban Gamliel, Shamar, Rabban Gamliel says, Hashkimu li shiva la'aliyah. Let's get 7 people up to the roof. The roof was the place where they did a lot of court business. Hishkim, they got up early. Umatzah shmona. Not 7, but 8. There are 8 people on the roof. Amar, mihu she'ala shelo birishud. Yered. Hey, whoever's here without permission, go down. Yered, get out of here. This is classic Rabban Gamliel, right? It's not happening my way. I'm going to yell at you. Okay? What happens next? Amad Shmuel HaKatan Valmar, Shmuel HaKatan stands up and says, Ani Ushaliti Shalom Rishud, I'm the one who stood up without permission. Vilola Berashana Aliti, I didn't come to actually intercalate the year. Ela Lilmor Alachamase Yitzrafti, I just needed to learn practical halacha. That's why I'm here. How does this land with Rabban Gamliel? Amarlo, shave, beni, shave. No, sit, stay, you're good. Ruyot kol hashanim kulan litaber al yadecha. Every year should be intercalated by the likes of you. Ela amru chachamim. It's just that the sages happened to say, and me'abrin hashanah ela b'mezumanin la. It just happened to have this rule. I'm sorry I got so upset. The 7 people, yes, you can stick around. Koda, v'lo Shmuel HaKatan haya. Actually, he wasn't number 8. He wasn't the guy who wasn't invited. Someone else wasn't. Ela Ine Shachrina was another guy who wasn't supposed to be there. Umachmat Kisufa Hudavi. He just did it because he wanted to prevent that person from feeling embarrassed. All right? Shmuel HaKatan has 2 features in these stories. One feature is Rabban Gamliel loves him. Okay? You're good. You stick around. Nothing's wrong with you. And number 2 is, he wants to prevent Rabban Gamliel from attacking other people, right? Mishum kisufa udavi. He did it because he wanted to prevent that sort of embarrassment. I'll show you one other example of how this plays out. Rebbe was sitting and teaching and smelled garlic. Have we ever been there? Totally. Totally. You're sitting, you're teaching a shiur, all of a sudden, you smell someone's garlic breath. He says, whoever ate garlic, Amar, Mishachal Shum, Yitze. Right? Forget about, I don't want to embarrass people in public and da da da. No, you ate the garlic, get out of here. Okay? This is Rabban Gamliel, totally in character. Amar Rabbi Chiya Viyatsa. Rabbi Chiya stood up and went out. Amdu Kulan Viyatsa Viyatsu. Everybody stood up and went out. In other words, it was the it was like a collective action, right? You're never going to know who had the garlic because we're all leaving, okay? The Breakfast Club, exactly. The Blue Wall of Silence. You pick your team. Okay. Rabbi Chiya. How did Rabbi Chiya know to do that? He's protecting the other guy, right? Rabbi Chiya, Mehecha Gmirle, how did he know? Where did he learn to do that kind of thing? Obviously, Rabbi Chiya was not the garlic breath guy, Right? He's the guy who's just leading the walkout. He learns it from Rabbi Meir. D'tanya, may not like it. Ma'aseh b'isha achat shebata lebeit midrasho shel Rabbi Meir. There was a woman who comes to the Beit Midrash of Rabbi Meir. Amra lo, she says, Rabbi echad mikem kicheni b'bia. One of your students did kiddushin with me through bia, through intercourse, not through kesef, which is the way Talmidei Chachamim are supposed to do it. Not through money or through a star or through a contract, but with bia. It's embarrassing. Amad Rabbi Meir v'katav la get kritut. Rabbi Meir himself writes her a get, meaning, I'm taking the fall, and so I'm divorcing you. V'natan la amdu kulam, amdu kadvu kulam v'nadula. Everybody stood up, wrote a get, and gave it to her. Rabbi Meir mehecha gemirla mishmuel akatan. The source of the guy who steps in to protect someone from public embarrassment is Akatan. He's the base case of this. Okay, he's the number one guy who steps in to protect the people. All right, now let's read it back into our story. Let's read it back into the Bavli. Because what I'm saying is Shmuel Katan is not randomly there. He's not even there because he's Katan Mishmuel Aramati, not because he has Nevuah, but because he's the guy who can control Rabban Gamliel's anger when it ignites. And he does it to protect innocent people who are otherwise going to get bulldozed by him, even if it goes against his principles, which I think is kind of an incredible thing that's going on here. Because all we know about him is he's the guy who doesn't like to say this bracha, but he's going to say it in order to protect someone else. We have to figure out who that is. You were going to say?
Yeah, so why you don't say, you know, the meaning bracha? We shouldn't rejoice when our enemies, you know, are transgressing or fall. And I think I'm starting to understand it a little bit better now with these stories. Is there a tie in here that Shmuel HaKatan, takes this action to prevent other people from falling, you know, falling to Rabban Gamliel's anger? So he's really trying to teach this, teaching by his actions the words of Mishlei.
Yeah. And I love him teaching by his actions because he actually doesn't say anything in Mishlei, meaning in Pirkei Avot. He literally innovates nothing. He's only the guy who acts. He's actually the guy who doesn't say things.
Right.
He doesn't say the bracha. But the other theory about Pirkei Avot is it's not just that there was Huaya Omer, but it's that they were mini biographies of their lives. If you take the phrases, Ayin Sadi Melamed has a thing on this, but it's like, if you take the little short pithy statements that the Avot are saying in Pirkei Avot, it's the thing that is the essence of their life. Rabbi Eliezer's is Yihi chavor chavercha chaviv alecha keshalcha. May the honor of your chaver be as dear to you as your own. We know that Rabbi Eliezer's whole life was characterized by his chaverim not showing him honor and excommunicating him, right? So it's like maybe this is the defining thing of his life, and that's how he ends up in Pirkei Avot. Okay, but let's just read the story one more time with this lens and see if we get to a different conclusion. Rabbi Gamliel says, "B'chol yom v'yom mipalel adam shmonasrei." Every single day, everybody who's a person says shmonasrei. Rabbi Yoshua says, "Me'en shmonasrei." Sound good? Machloket? No problem. We're good. It's the Mishnah. Maybe, maybe not. Right? Maybe Rabbi Gamliel is saying, "I'm going after Rabbi Yoshua, and I'm going to call in Shimon Apakuli. You come over here." Rabbi Yeshua, you think everyone can just do Me'en Shmon Asrei? Shimon Apakuli, you come here and say it. And he does say it. And he says it so well. The Rabban Gamliel says, Klum Yesh Adam She'odea L'taken Birkat. He did such a fantastic Birkat Aminim. Can anybody here even do any better? Right? See, Rabbi Yeshua? See, we can all say the Amida. Not this Me'en Shmon Asrei stuff. Every day, everybody's going to say the Amida, and they're going to say, "Look, fantastic, this random guy just did a fantastic Birkat Aminim." And then, Shmuel HaKatan, Amad. Why does he stand? Right? Amad Shmuel HaKatan. Is he like so small that he can't be heard unless he stands? Or is it because in the other story, he's also stand because he's a stand-up guy. He's standing up for you. Amad Shmuel HaKatan. He stands up standing against Rabban Gamliel, and he says, yes, I can do it. I actually can fix Birkat. I can make it better, right? And then it's backing away somehow the attack on Rabbi Yoshua. And then next year, yeah, you know what? I don't really like this bracha. I'm not going to say it. I'm going to forget it or whatever, right? I'm known in the Ushami as not saying it. So in the moment, I said it because I was stepping in to prevent the embarrassment, perhaps of Rabbi Yoshua. But I'm not, it's not really me. I'm more of a don't rejoice in the downfall of your enemies kind of guy, okay? And that, and in that way, the sort of like character, again, open up your like Siddur commentary. They're all going to tell you who wrote this bracha. Shmuel Katan wrote it. If you elide writing with Litakein, right? But what I'm saying, and you forget about the part where he doesn't say it anymore, right? But I'm saying there's something more complicated here about the author or the birth moment of this bracha, which is its birth in a moment of internal strife between Rabban Gamliel. It's like an interpersonal one-on-one fight between Rabban Gamliel and Rabbi Yoshua that's somehow baked into the moment of this bracha, like getting canonized. And so it just makes me wonder if it's as straightforward as, we've got some enemies, some of them are internal, some of them are external, let's schmeiß them, all of them. Okay? There's something else, there's something more complex that's going on here with the internal dynamics of the people who are saying the words, not the object of the words, but the ones who are writing the words. They're having their own fight, okay? And there's own, their own attacks and embarrassments that are at play, and maybe this is like an opportunity to recognize that. So, if you want to say Birkat, I mean, it's like evil in the world, check. Malchut Zadon, yes. Are there people who are out to get the Jewish people? Definitely. Do you want to say something about that in your Amidah? Potentially, right? For many hundreds of years, this is a very meaningful bracha for the Jewish people who are under attack from the, you name it, Rishayim, Oivim, Malshinim, etc. A lot of people who were the victims of the people who we were praying against. You want to say the bracha with that kavana? I'm not denying that to you. And yet, there's also another way you could relate to it, which is this something complex about the moment of its writing, and the person who is its champion also is the one who doesn't want to say it. And that's perhaps reflective of our sometimes ambiguous, ambivalent relationship with this bracha that ebbs and flows depending on sort of how we're feeling about the Jewish people. Yeah.
There's another part of this, that the issue of 18 and 19 with Litaken, like, who can still keep it 18 and yet integrate all these themes?
Right.
And Shmuel HaKatan, who would prefer to not include this theme, finds a way to integrate it and keep it 18.
But yeah, he like pulls it off.
Right.
Exactly. The Bavli asks a question in which the answer is this is number 19. But if you're just reading the Braita on its own, like maybe he's doing the kind of thing that the Tosefta is telling us to do, and he did it well, and maybe that's part of what's at play here.
So can you speculate a bit on what would be Shmuel HaKatan's objection to the Birkat HaMinim?
Yeah, this goes to Jonathan's point, right? What are my potentially principled objections, which might be wrapped up in, I don't want to rejoice in the downfall of my enemies, and even if I'm praying for the enemies to stop schmeissing me and I want them to be schmeissed, sometimes we go a little too far, and maybe we start rejoicing in the downfall of our enemies and we feel the schadenfreude, and it's not just a practical thing, it's like a attitude thing, and maybe that's what he's afraid might happen to the Jewish people if they lean into far to an otherwise legitimate request. Like, I don't want people turning me into the Roman governor. And I can ask for that. And yet, maybe I'm going a little too far around getting wrapped up and going against my enemies. Yeah, please.
Do you know if there's any debate about the liturgy becomes the morning blessing after the Shema? Because there's a lot of rejoicing in the downfall of the Egyptians there, right? I have a friend who teaches JTS who really, like, doesn't like to say it. He just feels it goes too far.
Yeah. I feel like, yeah. So first of all, the Gemara famously has the story of God saying, you're not going to sing while my creatures are drowning, although there are some flip sides of that. Right. And the pouring of the wine out of the Seder cup, it's also like, yeah, that was also a prophylactic of, I hope the plague doesn't hit me, as opposed to I'm reducing my joy. And you can find both sides to either of these things. I feel like, honestly, for those of us who like came of age in the in the end of the Cold War, it was like, who wants to pray against enemies? Who wants to pray? Who wants to rejoice in the downfall of the Egyptians? But in a world, I don't know, 20 years, 30 years earlier, it's like, yeah, you know what? When all of our enemies all of a sudden, karega yovedu, and they were pretty much, you know, taking a hammer to us nonstop, I might sing. You know, I might do that. So it's sort of like, where are we in that historical moment? It was a moment where people wouldn't say this bracha out loud. They were like whispering it. And I feel like that was the moment between, you know, the fall of the Soviet Union and like Al Qaeda. You know what I mean?
Right.
Something like in there, we all had like, oh God, is this
actually,
right?
Nope.
Yep. Rebbe said, it's forbidden for a person to pray that evil people depart from this world. For if the Holy One had removed Terach from the world when he was an idol worshiper, then Avram Avinu wouldn't have come into this world, right? And the tribes of Israel and King David and the King Mashiach would not have come to the world, and Torah would not have been given, and all those tzaddikim and chassidim and prophets would not have come to the world. In other words, think about who we're uprooting when we pray for their uprootingness, and are they going to have any yeshuvah l'Torah techa, maybe not themselves, but their children or their progeny, and how might that impact us? So my goal here was to sort of complicate while still, you know, ratifying the Birkat HaMinim, but to complicate its stories and its writing. And I hope it's a little bit more meaningful next time we say it.